Hello, Sophia here. I'm wondering if you've ever been curious about what it's like to work with a fashion stylist, or what a sex club is like for someone in a fat body, or what are the weight neutral approaches to PCOS treatment, or what I thought about the Aubrey Gordon Your Fat Friend film. Well, over on the Fat Joy newsletter, I am sharing these personal stories and practical strategies for living in our diet culture world. When you subscribe for free, you'll get an email from me about twice per month. I'm also recording video conversations with incredible fat people as well as amazing fat allies. And I want to share these people with you. So if you want some more Fat Joy, please go to fatjoy.substack.com. That is Fatjoy, FATJOY dot Substack, SUBSTACK.com. And subscribe to get all of this Fat Joy goodness in your inbox. Okay. Enjoy the rest of the episode. Hello, lovelies. Welcome to the Fat Joy podcast, where we talk each week about how to flourish in an anti-fat world. I'm Sophia Apostle, a fat professional coach who loves talking to other fat people about what it's like to live within oppressive systems that marginalize our bodies and how we still dare to have the audacity and courage to reach towards our collective liberation and embrace our joy. Please know this is an adult content podcast, so there will be swears. We will be talking about harms we've experienced, and we will be rebelling against weight stigma, diet culture, fat phobia, ableism, racism, etc. You can get more Fat Joy goodness, including how you can support the podcast, through my newsletter at fatjoy.substack.com. And for episode transcripts, book reviews, and show notes, head to the Fat Joy website at fatjoy.life. I am so glad you're here. Enjoy this episode. Hello, lovelies. Welcome to the Fat Joy podcast. I'm Sophia, and I am so excited for my guest today. I am talking with Parker McMullen Bushman. Hello, Parker.
Hello.
Welcome, welcome. I found Parker on social. I forget how exactly or who I was following, who shared something of yours, but I was so drawn to your images of you as a, if I may say, you tell me if this is wrong to say, but as a fat Black woman out in the wilderness. And there's even one image of you with a sign saying, "This is what a hiker looks like."
Yes.
And just kind of calling out images that we don't always see, especially in terms of like marketing and outdoor clothing apparel and, you know, travel guides, representing people who are often underrepresented. And of course, my interest is always in the fatness world because we're like never seen in outdoor ads. But then you also bring in the intersection with being a person of color. And I thought that was so interesting. And I'm excited to talk to you about all of that. So thank you for being here.
I'm so excited to be here. Thank you for having me.
Yay. Well, Parker, why don't you start by telling everyone a little bit about you?
Yeah. So hello, folks. I think your descriptor was good. I am a fat, Black, queer femme. And I currently reside in Denver, Colorado. I like to say that I wear a number of different head wraps instead of hats. So I have my fingers in the kind of outdoor recreation. My background is in environmental education. Spent a lot of time outdoors throughout my career. I also have the pleasure of running my own consulting organization where I get to work with primarily conservation and outdoor recreation-based organizations around diversity, equity, inclusion, justice, accessibility issues. And I'm also the co-founder of Inclusive Guide, which is an online review platform where people can rate places and spaces based on you know, how this service was in relation to their identity. And then we looked for trends. So maybe like there's a place that is great for Black women, but plus size Black women have trouble when they go there, right? Or it's great for Asian men, but white women in wheelchairs have trouble when they go there. So we look for trends. In addition to all of that, you know, I stay active in my local community and organizing community events and getting people together to talk about social justice issues. I sneak hikes in between all of that. And I'm a parent. I've got three kiddos that me and my partner raise in a very full house that also includes both of our fathers and my niece and her child. So we've got a lot of things going, but it's wonderful.
Wow. That's a lot of bodies in one house. Oh my goodness.
Nine people. Count them. Nine.
Wow. I love that. And we're going to, I'm so excited to talk to you about all those aspects of the work that you do. You're a fellow multi-hyphenate, someone who does all the things. So Parker, my second question to guests always is about the word fat, and your journey with relationship to this word. What has that been like for you over your life?
You know, I've always been fat. I don't think I've always been comfortable being fat, but I have always been fat. I was always kind of the larger kid in the classroom. Some of my first like memories are like thoughts about it. I remember that my mom had Jane Fonda workout. I might be dating myself, right? But the Jane Fonda workout videos and like the books that you could get that would show you different moves, exercise moves. And I remember at some point, I think it must have been around fifth grade. It was definitely younger than that, but like of having this idea that I was bigger and that was an issue. I think when I was younger, in like third and fourth grade, I remember thinking about it, being a little bit worried about it. I had a cousin who, you know, told me, well, you're big boned, right? Some we say in the Black community, you're big bone. And when you get older, you'll thin out, right? So I was always kind of waiting for that time. But I remember getting into fifth grade, I felt like, oh, I need to do something about this. And this was when I first had an understanding of like calories. And I remember being like, I'm going to put myself on a diet and I'm going to eat 500 calories a day. And like going to our refrigerator and trying to look at the different like calorie amounts and eating something that wasn't even healthy. I think like my mom had, you know, like maybe it was a couple of candies or something in the fridge. But I remember eating something and being like, okay, these are the amount of calories that I could have for the day, and like ate it, and then was like, oh no, like, what do I do? Like a few hours later, because I am absolutely starving and I've eaten my calories for the day. So like, I remember that and just having this feeling of like wanting to kind of look like some of the other folks that I saw around me. My mom, what I think was pretty, you know, she didn't really shame me, but some of that came from some of the older folks in my Black community, because I think over time we've kind of been changing as a country our relationship to fatness. And so, you know, I think as I got older, I I still thought of myself as being beautiful, or like having the possibility to be beautiful. I remember trying out for certain things and having people, my dad, take my picture because I was going to send it in to maybe it's Teen Magazine for like one of their like teen model competitions. And I was still convinced that I would win. And I think that then I learned about some other things about how my beauty as a Black person was perceived, but that came later. So I think that I've always had a relationship and an understanding and some like questioning about it, but unlike some other people that I've talked to, I didn't feel like it totally crushed like my self-esteem about myself. And then I got to a point when I got older and I was, I got dates, I was dating people and like doing things that it didn't seem, it's like, okay, maybe this is just who I am and I'll try. I've had different bouts of on the weight loss journey. And at some point I just came to, well, I'm just going to try and be active, right? And as much as I can, and I'm not going to punish myself or feel bad for other people's perception of me, right? And that has been really kind of a healing journey. And then when I got into social media, I realized that, wow, this is a message and representation that is so needed, and that there are a lot of people that have been told the messages of that you are not good enough if you have a certain body type, and that my hope is that me just trying to like live my best life and do the things that I do can help people to see that you don't have to have a certain body type to do that, which I think is really important. But I still get so many haters. Like I do a lot of hiking. I try new outdoor activities and it's always like, oh, she's not hiking anywhere but to McDonald's, or, they're not doing really anything that's going to help their body, or, if you, or even like passive aggressive things. Like I just did a skiing video that I was so excited about with my friend who's also an influencer, Fat Black and Getting It, Nelson is his name. And we went skiing and people were like, oh, and imagine like if you keep that up, you'll lose so much weight, So it's still out there and people are still dealing with it. But I try to be like that beacon of like, we can do this and we can feel good about ourselves. And it's sad to see when people don't have those opportunities and are not getting those messages and they're not being told that they're beautiful, not in spite of their weight, but that they're just beautiful. Like, so I don't know, it's an interesting relationship, it's definitely been there. I definitely have had times I think that I have said, maybe I should, I want to make a change or I want to do this, but based off of what other people have said to me and their perception of me, right? And when I got past that, I felt so much happier, right? And I'm like, who knows where I'll be in my weight, but I know that that does not define me as a human, and I'm not doing anything to say I'm going to lose this weight to be a better person, because I think that's BS.
Yeah. Oh, yes, yes, yes to everything you said, Parker. I'm also wondering, because we all hold multiple identities, but the other identities that you named were being Black and being queer. Do you find that fatness, Blackness, and queerness kind of almost had like a braided journey? Like, did they interact with each other in interesting ways?
They do. It also interacts with your, how accepted you are in situations, right? Like, what is the saying in the Yeah, I'm sure this is a saying everywhere, right? That I hear it a lot in the Black community, like pick a struggle, right? And I think that your like perception, the way that people perceive me is different. And we know that those intersections pile on. If I was just a Black person, right? But I could fit some of those traditional norms, and we're all talking about like, do you say white supremacy? Because we're talking about white supremacy, right? We're talking those norms around body build and around like how you should look and show up, how you should act in certain spaces, like all of these things, even like sexuality norms. Like I think about like gender and sexuality and how there are still tribes today in Africa where kids choose their gender when they're 13, right? Like because they know that those things change over time and people's perceptions and their roles that they want to be in, right? And how they want to project themselves might change over time. And that different ways of being in relationships with people in a lot of our indigenous, groups are different and they're varied. And what we look at today within our society of this is how you have to show up, right? And your proximity to showing up that way, like, who is at the pinnacle? We have white men and white women who are thin, who have that like perfect hair, who make a lot of money, who have like all of these different things. And then you are more acceptable, your closeness to that, right? So if I was a thin Black person who had straight hair and who could code switch in all the ways that were needed to, like how I would be accepted would be different. But the fact that I'm not only Black, right, but also queer, also fat, also non-binary, like all of these things move me further away from that ideal. And the judgment comes from how far you are away from that ideal. But I love that people are loving themselves now. Like I saw the best meme that was like, I'm so mad. It said something like, I'm so mad because people don't hate themselves anymore. Right. And I think about how that almost like takes power away. If I don't want to be by your expectations, if I don't care, you call me fat and okay. Like it's a descriptor, like true and beautiful and sexy and getting it and active and powerful. Like what? It's like just another descriptor. And like, I want to see more of that power taken away because they will pile it on. They're like, what are your intersections? And yes, these are all the biases that I have because of those intersections. And I would say, let's shut it down.
Yeah. Yes. Well, and I mean, you're really, I feel like right now you're speaking it to me, to us, in a way that really aligns with the EDI work you do. Right. And so how did you get interested in that? How did you decide to become an activist in this way?
So, I said earlier, my background is in environmental education, and that was not a career that I realized that I could do. Like I fell into it. When I was in third grade, I told someone that I wanted to be a neurosurgeon because like I'd heard about that career somewhere and got the like biggest response that I was like, oh, okay, I'm just going to stick with this. So like third grade, through like my second year of college, I was going to be a doctor. And I thought that that was my calling. And then I got into college and started getting into some of the studies. And I was like, oh, no. Like, I can do so many things. I am so good at so many things. And I also feel like I should know when to stop. And so I switched into anthropology, which was an awakening for me and just amazing. And did anthropology and sociology, got done with my degree. There were not a whole lot of jobs for Indiana Jones. And also, like, if you think about like what it takes to really do a career like that, you need a lot of mentorship, you need connections, you need people. And I didn't have anyone like guiding me or helping me along in that way, or the community connections to get me there. So I was after my college and really like at a loss for what I should be doing. But I had been a camp counselor, and someone, you know, said to me, well, you know, during the year, a lot of camps have these EE programs, environmental education programs. And, you know, you don't have to have really a specialized degree. You just have to enjoy, be able to teach well and enjoy working with kids, and they provide you room and board. And so I was like, okay, let me give that a try. And started my first residential environmental learning job as a stopgap. I was like, I need to know what I'm doing with my life. So I was going to like do that as a stopgap, and then turn around 4 years later. And I was like, maybe this is my career. But getting into that space was difficult for me. You know, first of all, like sending, that was back in the day where you would like mail your application out to places and hope that you would get a response or a call back for certain jobs. And I was having trouble getting callbacks. Someone told me, maybe you should start using your middle name, right? Which is hence kind of Parker developed. And then I started getting callbacks and hiring, and got into the space and was like, there is no one like me in this space. And I felt like I needed to stop wearing my head wraps, and that I needed to like act a certain way. I needed to go out and buy a fleece. I needed to like all of the things to like fit into outdoor recreation and environmental education fields. And so I did a lot of adapting. And then I got kind of further in my career and was like, does it need to be this way? I went back to school and decided to get my master's of science in natural resources with a focus on environmental education and interpretation. And during that time, doing research for my project and things, started really thinking about kind of some of the disparities in access to nature, disparities in like understanding about things like climate change, and also saw with my colleagues some of the troubles that they had working with very diverse groups. You know, like kids would come, we'd get, I spent time working in Georgia, we'd get kids coming in from Atlanta, had never been to the beach, and that's where my center was. And they wouldn't want to get their like nice shoes dirty, you know, that they'd spent a lot of money on their sneakers, and the staff didn't understand. They didn't want to get their hair wet and got worried if it would start raining, these little Black kids, and the staff didn't understand and had trouble relating to them. And it was always my favorite to get those groups. Like, I love those groups of little Black kids. I had, you know, one kid, I was walking on the beach and he was collecting shells, and he came up to me and he was like, excuse me, miss, who I gotta pay for these shells? And I was like, you don't gotta pay nobody, because nature is free. Like, you don't gotta pay nobody. And like just that kid's face lighting up. And I was like, it is a real problem that we don't see more people of color in these spaces. And doing the research around the history and having an understanding of, okay, yeah, my dad grew up in Georgia, born in 1950. Jim Crow laws were in place until 1965. Parks and places were supposed to provide separate but equal park facilities, but a lot of places did not. In the South, like a lot of superintendents were like, oh, well, we're going to hold on to this money and see if Black people really want to go to the outdoors. And then like would spread rumors like Black people didn't want to go outside, so we don't need to build these spaces. So his access to safe spaces in nature that were enjoyable, right? Because yes, he was out in nature. He picked cotton. My dad, as a little kid in the South, was picking cotton, right, to get 10 cents a day to be able to buy chicken and a gallon of milk to feed his family, you know? And so it's no wonder without him having those experiences that he never took me to a national park. I never knew a national park existed until I was in my 20s, right? And it's no wonder with examples of historical ways of keeping people from accessing these spaces that we have this disconnect. But a lot of organizations are like, oh, we're in the here and now. And so I kind of took on this thing. I was like, no, we need to have these conversations. And organizations want to be more diverse and they want to be inclusive. Like, they're trying, they want to be, but sometimes they're missing the mark because they don't understand all of the connecting points, how history ties into where we currently are, and how, you know, it's not enough to just say, we're open to all, we're welcome, everybody's welcome. But like, you have to actually change and think about this culture that was designed to not include people of color at so many different levels, and how do we change that? And so that's how I got into this work. I formed Eco-Inclusive Strategies in 2013, so it's almost coming up on 11 years. And then, you know, a few years ago, 3 years ago, I was able to step out of my day job and full-time be kind of immersed in this work. And it's been really wonderful.
Oh, wow. I'm so happy to hear that organizations are wanting to do this, especially within that space. And how cool that you're really niched into, or niched, because I'm talking, you're in the US. I'm in Canada, we say niche, you say niche. You're niched into that area so perfectly with what your whole background is.
Yeah, I love it. And I also love people are talking about, it's not only racial inclusion, but we're talking about fat inclusion in the outdoors too.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's been really great. So I got the opportunity. I got an award this past year at the Outdoor Media Summit. They named me Influencer of the Year. And I got to do a session there about, fat folks in outdoor recreation. And there were two brands that I presented alongside. And we talked about how, you know, I forgot the exact number, but I think it was like 25, 21% like of the population are now, you know, would be identified as obese. You know, I think it might even be more, but so don't quote me on that number, but it's a big number. Right? It's a big number. I think it's more. And how brands are really outdoor brands, because of their biases, think that fat folks don't want to get out into the outdoors. And it's not true. And I can tell them it's not true because I see the comments on my page. And a lot of people are like, I would like to go, but like, you know, we just went skiing. And I had folks telling me like, do you have recommendation for ski boots that have wide calves? Because I did try to go once and enjoyed it, but it cut off the circulation to my legs and it was really, really painful. And so I can't go back until I can find something. And so they're leaving out an entire market of people who want to get out and be active. And it's a catch, it's a effing catch 22. Because if you are a fat person and you're out being active, then you get the hater comments, right? And if you're a fat person who's like, I'm chill, because you don't have to be a fat person that's being active. You can live your life, right? But if you're a fat person that's like, I'm chill, people are like, why aren't you more active? You're like, I go, like anywhere I go, y'all are going to harass me, like whatever I'm doing, you know, and it's really sad.
Yeah. Well, and you even mentioned skiing, like not only boots, but I cannot find snow pants. You know, like I can find a jacket, but I cannot find good snow pants for I'm like a size 24, 26 body. So if anyone has a recommendation.
And I wish Nelson had such a good recommendation, because he got, oh goodness, I'm not remembering the company, but he found a company that does outdoor gear sizes for, I think, like up to like a 32. And, you know, wore their gear when we went and kind of hyped them up. And it's good because there's not a whole lot of companies doing it. And companies that are trying to do it are not doing it well. So they're doing things like, oh, you know, backpacks, right? If you're going to be hiking and you have a big backpack, you want something that fits to your form, to your curves, to your sides. And what a lot of people are doing are like, okay, we're taking our regular backpack and just extending, adding extra fabric to extend the like belt around. Well, that don't do me no good if the belt is behind the pocket that is in the belt is way behind me because you didn't move it. You just extended the belt loop. Like they're not thinking and designing, you know, for people. And then because they're not consistent about it, they get, you know, they're like, oh, I don't know if this is what we, you know, like companies do. They pull it. They'll do small runs. People are like, I don't trust you. Yeah, because you ain't had nothing. I don't know if this is going to fit, whatever. So they do these like small runs and then they give up because they're not consistent, then they're not gaining the customers because people don't want, you know, we get our companies, we get our places. Not only am I fat, I got big feet, right? We're going to go there. I got big feet. I wear like a 12 or 13 in women's sizes. So I often need to wear male size shoes, which I hate, like the colors, the everything. Like why we got to do like that?
Brown, just brown,
right? Just brown. And so like I was like, Payless Shoe Source, because they were a company that I could go into shop and they reliably had 12 and 13 size shoes. They shut down. I was like loyal to them for years because of those shoes. And then they shut down. And what I'm trying to say is like, we get our like brands as people who are who they're not making stuff for, right? When you find a company, like you get loyal to that place and then those are the places you go to shop, and brands are not giving enough time for people to like find out like, okay, you're making this stuff and we want to be involved. So we're going to work with you as well, right?
So yeah. It's so true. I interviewed Andrea Kelly, who worked in the outdoor space. I believe Andrea worked at Columbia River. Yes, worked at Columbia River Trading Company, and is now a consultant specifically working with fashion and outdoor brands, because that was her background, with her company called Make Plus Equal, to help them actually like what it takes to size up in exactly the way you're speaking about, which is like with design in mind and intentionality and, you know, working with fat bodies and even having like fat, what are those like, oh, not mannequins, but those things where you like create around, you put the fabric on it and just even like there's
the forms. I got one. I found one.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah. My size. Yeah.
Right. Well, you know, so there is, but look, you know, that's one person, and that's I hopefully there's more than just Andrea, but it was a fascinating conversation about all the reasons what we were just talking about, like how challenging it is for them and how if there's not immediate return on their investment, they're like, no, we're pulling the plug, which is very frustrating because then, yeah, then, and I hear this all the time from people. Yes, I would like to do this thing, but I can't find XYZ clothing or shoe or backpack that actually works for my body. I'm struggling with this right now. I honestly, Parker, I'm trying to find a very simple, like tank top, bathing suit top. And I can find nothing because I want to go and swim laps. I don't need peplum. I don't need sleeves. I don't need like all the plus size, like tankini tops have all this accoutrement. And I just want a plain tank top.
They love a peplum. I can't lie, I love a peplum as well. But like, they look like so much in plus size fashion. It's like, yeah, they're like that. And then like the patterns and the.
Yeah. So it's hard. It makes it hard. I mean, I don't have a top to go swim in. I'm like, this is ridiculous.
So I looked it up. My statistic, right? And it is 41.9% of the population, right, are fat folks.
I've actually even heard higher. The one that I hear the most is 65 to 68% of the population is a size 14, 16 and higher. So considered plus size. Yeah.
And which is considered plus size. But what I love, not love, but what's interesting about the statistic, if they break it down by race, right? Non-Hispanic Black adults in the U.S. Are 49.9%, so almost 50%, and have the highest age-adjusted prevalence of being fat, followed by Hispanic at 45%, and then white adults at 41%. And Asian adults have the least. And so what is interesting is then getting back to the scales and how, not the scales, but how they created the BMI, right? And obesity measurement.
Yeah, we're putting quotes around the word obesity because we do hate that word. Yeah, yeah.
Sorry, using the term that the CDC uses, like their measurements, right, were based, again, white supremacy on white folks, right? So
white Northern European men, actually, which is ridiculous. And our whole insurance system, our whole everything is based on Northern European white dudes that were in the army. Come on. It's just ridiculous.
And so as a fat person, like thinking of as a fat Black person, thinking about that and thinking about how, you know, sometimes even in plus size clothing, it's difficult for me to find something that fits me because it was not made for me. Like the way that weight sits on me is a little bit different than if I sit on someone else, right? And we got our little form, but it never takes in the context my butt, like it never, like all of these things that are not adjusted for because it never was fitted to my body type anyway. And so even I think about the fact that Black folks that I know that even would be and that I do not think of, I just don't think they're not fat, right? Are called fat and said that they're fat because of this like measurement that was not made for those body types, whatever.
Yeah, it's so true. It's so true. Oh, and it's so frustrating. And with the work that you do at Eco Inclusive, I'm so happy to hear that sizeism is being discussed. Because I will say, as someone who's done quite a now at this point in my kind of life, I've done quite a bit of EDI training and learning. And every time I go to an EDI talk, or you know, there's you know an anti-oppression educator that comes in with the various organizations I work with, I'm always so excited and so hopeful that fatness, size will be mentioned. And may I tell you that 95% of the time, it is not. And then I'm the fat person who raises her hand and is like, well, "What about sizeism? Don't forget about that." So I imagine you doing this work, it becomes part of the conversation more easily because it's a reality that you occupy, right? And you bring it in.
Sizeism is also, I talk about it as well as how it's tied to ableism.
Yes,
and yes. The way that people view, like even in conversations about fatness, like people's ideas that, Oh, well, I'm just telling you this because of your health, and I care about your health. And I'm like, there's so many things that is wrong with that. First of all, you know nothing about my health, and you're making an assumption based on something, based on viewing me, that would be rude if I did, if I looked any other way, right? If I was not a fat person, if you said that to a skinny person, asked about their health, it would be rude. And there are skinny people who have a myriad of health issues, but you don't ask them because you don't make an assumption about them based on the way that they look, right? But people love to like, and it's so tied in. And then they're like, well, you know, well, I'm just thinking about like, you're going to be disabled. You're going to get this and this and this and that. And I'm like, okay, so also, can we talk about your ableism? Because why do you have such a stigma? Like we have said in our society that to be disabled is the worst thing in the world. And that, you know, I'm like watching television and they're like episodes of medical dramas where people like come back from an accident and they're like, you should have just let me die. I'm going to live the rest of my life without use of my legs or whatever. Like we have this awful thing that is also like there's a root. Okay. We're talking about sizeism and fatness tied to ableism and disability, tied to American values here in America of rustic individualism. I don't know. Is that big in Canada?
I mean, yeah, a little less so, but it is. Yeah. Yeah.
Rugged individualism that says that if you need any type of community help, if you cannot do everything on your own, then you are less of a person, right? In life, your life is worth less, literally. And so in order to keep capitalism going, right, they have to have that like value of this rugged independence and like everybody is an individual that doesn't depend on community and collectivism, but that we are all individuals, right? And so that ties into, well, if you are a disabled person, then you are less than in life. And the worst thing to be is a disabled person because you can't do, some disabled people are not able to do everything on their own. And so that makes you less of a human. And if you are fat and you're gonna like, it all ties in, together, right? And it's so disgusting the way that we value, we think of our earth, we think of our air, our plants, the land, humans as commodities to be used for amassing wealth, right? And so like body image is tied into all of that. It's all one big messy ball of disgusting yarn that I want to throw out the window.
Oh my gosh. Would that you could. I wish you could just take it and get rid of it. I mean, you're working at it. You're doing it bit by bit. Right. Oh, I know. Well, and thank you for just like the way you just set all that up and all the connections and how it is all interconnected and this impacts this and it's because of this. Like, it's so clear. One of the things that always surprises me is that now that I've seen it, I can't unsee it and I see it everywhere. My guess is that part of the work that you do, perhaps part of the challenge is getting people to the point where they can see it. Do you encounter a lot of resistance? And for anyone listening, perhaps even who's like, I don't know if I buy the white supremacy capitalist thing, how do we move people forward in their thinking?
So, and I thank you again. Let's say, okay, because I just want to explain everything. Get back, right? Yeah, I think that, you know, it moving people forward has to do with like looking at the world differently than we have been taught and programmed to look at the world. And like when we talk about something like white supremacy and even like privilege, those are really triggering words, I think, for some people. When we've thought of white supremacy, we have traditionally thought of people burning crosses in someone's front yard, right? And that's been like the KKK, like that's been the face, neo-Nazis of white supremacists. But in, you know, more recent times, we're realizing that that definition doesn't serve us well. Because white supremacy, right, we all know it basically says, oh, white people are better than other groups of people, and so have the right to kind of control what other groups do. And if you ask, I think, an average white person, they would say, no, that's not, I don't believe that, that's not true, that I don't think that that is, and they don't even see or think that that's how systems work, right? Because it's hard once you're in the system. But, you know, thinking about it is important because it's not only that, we can see evidence of that in what is the default, right? And so some of the things I've been talking about is what is the default. And like an example would be when I was a kid, I had a crayon box, right? And it had a flesh-colored crayon in it. That flesh-colored crayon was not the color of my flesh, right, as a Black person. Or like when I go and buy nude pantyhose, right? It's not like my color to be nude, right? My color always has something like a chocolatey honey chocolate or something, you know, but it's not nude, right? Because I am not the default when we think of nude skin, right? And so we can see white supremacy in what is thought of to be the default. And so when we think about like the pseudo whatever scientific methods of like talking about body size, right? And what was the default for that? You said white European, you know, descent males, right? That is, was the default that everybody else is judged against, even though lots of people have lots of different body types, right? And so I think that we have to be willing to say, okay, are we seeing these defaults and how do we rectify it? Because that's kind of where privilege comes from. Privilege is when you are the default. Privilege is when there have been systems that are built with you in mind. And racial privilege is not the only type of privilege. I think we've had a lot of conversations about that in the last few years. And so it sticks highly in people's mind. But white privilege, not the only type of privilege, right? And so like as a person who doesn't have any mobility disabilities, I have able-bodied privilege in a lot of the spaces that I go into. And so if I go up, like to go to the courthouse and there's steps all the way up into the front door and there's not a ramp, right? And that building has been around for how many years? And like I look at that space and I don't have trouble accessing it. I have the privilege of walking up those steps very easily to go inside because it was a space designed with able-bodied people in mind. And I am the default in that scenario, right? And so when we think about privilege and we think about what are the ways, because you don't, when you are the default, it's very hard to see. You don't think about it. I'm not walking up steps like, oh, I'm able-bodied, right? Like, it's just, I'm going about my day. It's a lot easier to see when you're not the default and when things are not designed with you in mind. And we have a system that has been like, who was at the beginning of the founding of my country here in the US? We had white males who were not just any old white male, also land owning wealthy white males, right? And so, and that's always been the default here in the US, that it is white males who have wealth, right, that are given and kept the power going. And it's hard like that, even when I show statistics, like here in the US, white males that are 31% of the population occupy 65% of elected positions, leadership positions. Almost 90% of Fortune 500 CEO companies, like all of these things, like you can see the numbers and realize that there's disparities in a highly changing country, but people still hold on to that as the right way for it to be. So like I post about it and people are like, well, you want it to be like a shit old country in Africa? Do you want it to, you know, be like this? Or who you want to put black people in charge? Or white people make up 60% of the population, so this number makes sense. Totally erasing white women, right? And they our brains are like, well, this is the reason, and try to create a reason for the disparities, for the bias, rather than challenging it head on. And rather than saying, wait a second, like that doesn't make sense. And it surprises me the number of people who will look away against their own interests, right? Because whiteness is a relatively new concept, right? And if you are a white person with intersections of other identity, how quickly white supremacy will leave you behind, right? And well, like if you're a white queer person, if you're a white person with disability, right? That like white privilege just isn't like the same across the board. Like, because when it intersects with other identities, people get treated differently, right? And but people will still vote against their interests, right? Even if they're like, this isn't really serving me, right? The system, even as a white person, they will still talk against their interests, vote against the poor white people, right? Have been conned into believing that, like, that, yes, this system serves me. And it doesn't serve you, right? It's not serving any of us. Like, I want not only liberation for, you know, people of color, for other folks, but I want liberation for white people too. Like, I think that this is a community. We're whole. We're together. Like, I don't want things to divide me from people in my community. I want to be connected. And there are a few folks pulling the strings. I don't know if people have seen the meme with, like, there's like three people at a table. There's a black guy, a white guy, and another white guy in a suit. And he has the white guy in the suit has like a plate piled up with cookies, and the white guy next to him is sitting with like a couple of cookies on his plate. And then like the black guy, I think, has either less cookies or no cookies. And the white guy in the suit is saying to the other white guy, he's trying to steal your cookies, right? While meanwhile, he's got this giant pile, right? And this like idea that we have a few people at the top is how it's always been since the beginning. Like, they created this country and it was built on rich white males who then turned around and said, oh no, we can't have poor white people and poor people of color getting together. They're going to come after us. Like, we need to tell them that it's okay. We need to expand also this definition of white people, because like 200 years ago, some of y'all wouldn't have been white. Like, some of y'all were not considered white. Italian people, like, other people were not.
I'm Greek. I wasn't. I've like seen.
You were not white. You were not white, right? And then they were like, oh, wait, they're going to overrun us. We need to get numbers. Okay. Like, okay, you white, right? And the other set, sorry.
It's so good. It's so good. I'm so in.
Because the other sad thing about it is, and I love that you're like, I'm Greek. You know your ethnicity. A lot of white people don't know their ethnicity. They've been separated from it as another means of white supremacy to say, look, okay, you got to leave that stuff behind. You're Italian, you're Greek, whatever. Leave that behind. You are white American, right? They keep saying like, oh, you're not this. You don't have that ethnicity. When America was made up of all of these groups of people coming together, it is different than other countries, right? Like, we were made with these people coming together, and we have said that in order to be American, you have to give up your ethnicity, right? To be American. And that's all like race, you can be a race, but you have to give up your ethnicity, basically, like where those family and ethnicity is different from race. Here's another lesson, because a lot of people don't know the difference between race and ethnicity. Race, relatively new concept, right? And it came around like Carl Linnaeus was out there putting labels on everything, right? And started to create labels for people. He's like, let's label people too. And even in his first like thing, he had black, white, yellow, red, right? Where the groupings of people. His description held white supremacy. Like, white people were at the top. They were the most learned and educated and this and that. Said things, you know, people who were yellow, which, you know, it's a slur today, right? But that's what, like, yellow meant Asian people. Red people meant indigenous people. Black people meant, you know, people of African and other descents, Caribbean, whatever. Like, each one of those had awful things. Black people, we were lazy and ruled by caprice, right? And like all of these other things that he said about people. And they started at that point, right? It starts the erasure of ethnicities, because if you're Greek and you're Italian, right? You're different ethnicities, and those ethnicities come with like food and tradition and holidays and language and all of this stuff. But now, no, you're both white, right? Like, no, everybody fits under. Join the club, you're both white, right? A black person from Caribbean, black person from, you're black, right? Yeah, same thing, right? And an erasure of all of this like rich culture to be put under this one umbrella. And now, generations later, white people don't know what they've missed. They don't know what's been taken from them. And they're looking at me and saying, you're not from Africa. Why are you called African American, right? And like, first of all, my family ancestors got stolen, right? Like, you know, like, sorry for the inconvenience of the callback. So, you know, there's been so much under this guise of white supremacy and whiteness, so much that's been given up, taken from lots of groups of people. And I just hope, like, if people are like, I'm not sure about this, like, I don't really know what you're saying, it doesn't seem like it applies to my life, I hope that just the thought of like, wait a second, what have I lost? What's been taken from me? What is the heritage, the history that maybe I don't know about, right? And then like what we talk, sorry, I'm gonna stop right after this. Talking about appropriation, right? When I think about people who are like, oh, they are finding things in these indigenous cultures that they're like, I resonate with. So I'm going to like either copy the garb or the tradition or whatever, without an understanding that, yeah, it's cool. Like appreciation is different than appropriation, but also you have a heritage and a history that you're probably, like, everybody's indigenous to somewhere, right? And I think that cut off from that past has led people to try and find like, well, what, you know, I'm going to make up my, which you can, like, everybody has the right, but like, I'm going to pull from this and pull from that because I am missing something that was taken away from me, you know? So, okay. So, breath.
Oh, so much wisdom, Parker. I love everything you just said. The way you weave these concepts together, and I mean, you're telling us the story of our own oppression. And I think the way you just did that I know we just got a little snippet of what is your entire wisdom, but that was really powerful. And I resonate with everything that you said. And the whole time you were talking, I just kept thinking, oh, I wish, I'm a big fan of Octavia Butler. And I was like, I wish she had written what we could have been. Cause you know, she's very dystopic in a lot of her writing. I'm like, I wonder if she had like a really happy, like couple months and could have written what, like almost like an alternate history at that moment, instead of division of all these different groups, people coming together at the founding, what if it wasn't just the white dudes who like command and controlled everything? Like what if I just, oh,
goodness, I love her so much. Writings. If you're listening and you ain't read an Octavia Butler book, like go in and drop what you're doing and get it.
I mean, I think she was a prophet. When I read the parable books, I was like, oh shit, that is happening right now. Like, no.
Make America great again. I had to look up like when. Like, when is this written? Like,
yes. Pre-Trump. I mean, she called it. Parker, this has been incredible. Thank you. I have one last question before we close. I always joke like this podcast was born out of my rage. So of course it had to be about joy. But then when we talk, we mostly talk about rage. But the very last question is about joy. So. Because I think joy is a part of it. I actually find rage quite joyful. And you know, with all the work that you do, you are about bringing as much liberation into this world as you can, group by group, person by person, you know, viewer by viewer of your socials. And that's hard work. And I imagine it's exhausting at times. So how do you choose joy? How do you stay connected to joy? What's your joy practice?
Yeah, you know, I find joy in my community, which is weird. Like people see me and I think they're like, oh, that's an extrovert. And I'm not, you know, I love time alone and I don't necessarily get energy from like interactions in big groups. But I put myself in big groups because I do find joy in connection and in bringing together lots of different groups of people. And so I will have some like community events, or I'll even have like a party at my house. And I look around, there's like 40 people there, and they are all different ethnicities and races and able-bodied and disabled and like just like everything, queer, straight, like just such the myriad, fat, thin, like all straight sides, all sorts of things and people and identities and ways of looking at the world. And it gives me joy when we break bread together and connect together and say that, you know, the things that we see going on, like there's a lot of division, but we're coming together and choosing joy and choosing to spend time and lift each other up. And that gives me just, you know, so much happiness to be there in that space.
Yeah. Oh, that sounds just blissful. Thank you for sharing a little slice of your joy with us. Parker, thank you so much for being here. I have learned so much from you. I was scribbling all over my paper and I'm just so happy to know you.
And so thank you so much for having me. Yeah, this has been wonderful. And, you know, thank you all for listening. If you made it this far, thank you so much for listening to my tangents.
I love it. I like good tangents. Good tangents. Before we go, I'd like to read a poem, because poetry can reach our hearts in a different way. Poems can have us feel in a different way. And that's what this podcast is all about. Expanding our hearts, deepening our empathy, and inviting in joy.
So each week, you get a new poem.
Parker's connection to nature and the extension of that invitation to us is so generous. Parker wants to invite us into her world, just like this poem by Malgosia Haliup does. And I know Malgosia. I am so happy to read this poem. It is called Teach Me. It's time to write about moss, how it tells the health of the place where it thrives, how it grows, dries as if to imitate death, then revives with water. The smallest things are sometimes hardest to kill, fooling us into believing dormancy is a permanent surrender. My hand on these soft green curls of growth, stone transmuting into mammal's back, tree to a vertical landscape sprawling with forests. I am learning your names. I heed your attunement to the forms that host you, your state between occupation and yielding. Teach me to be as indestructible as you are, and even half as tender.
Thank you for joining me today. My hope is that you're feeling a little less alone and a little more seen. So until the next episode, you can find me on Instagram at fatjoy.life, on YouTube at youtube.com/@fatjoy, and on Substack at fatjoy.substack.com. And please do check out the episode notes for how you can connect with my amazing guest and for the links to the poem. All right, lovely, I am sending you off with my best wishes for an abundantly fat joy day, and we'll talk again soon.